This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is out today. Eminent domain battles are always an emotional issue, especially for those personally affected. But last month's Supreme Court ruling allowing cities to use eminent domain to give property to private developers has turned the issue into a national debate. In communities across the country, urban planners hope to use the ruling to address blight and bring much-needed revenue and redevelopment to rundown areas. And in many of those same communities, business owners and residents are decrying the loss of family businesses and family homes to enrich private developers. States are in the fight, too, with some state legislatures considering ways to limit the new powers granted by the Supreme Court, backed by an unusual coalition of liberal and conservative groups. This hour on Talk of the Nation, the new battlegrounds in eminent domain. How much power should communities have to direct their growth? Are private developments also a public good? How is this debate going to play out around the country? We'll talk with both sides in the current eminent domain battle and get a bigger picture of what's going on around the country. And we want to hear from you. Is your town or state debating these expanded powers of eminent domain? We especially want to hear from people involved in eminent domain cases, property owners, developers, lawyers, urban planners, and civic leaders. What's your story? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We start today with a specific story on the use of eminent domain. In Oakland, California, the city wants to turn several blocks around a commuter train station into a development known as the Uptown Project, with shops and 1,200 apartments and condominiums. Early this month, less than a week after the Supreme Court's ruling, the city evicted the last two holdout businesses. We're joined now by the former owner of one of them, John Ravelli of Ravelli Tire. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I know the city offered you market value for your shop. Why did you decide to fight the city in its eminent domain attempt, despite the fact that they did offer you market value?
Well, what they say market value is not realistic compared to what real estate prices have done in the area. They hire their appraiser, and of course they come in with a number that they say is fair market value. But when they, in last November, when they had a meeting to vote on the resolution of necessity, which is the pre-step for them to use the power of eminent domain, how that works is that they come in and say, this is what we feel your property is worth, and you have 90 days to vacate, and if you don't agree with that, then you have to hire an attorney and fight against that.
So the Supreme Court ruling, is that it for you? Does that mean that you have no recourse now, no legal recourse?
Well, we have to... in terms of the compensation, this is what we have to fight for now.
So now you're just trying to get more than what they are saying is market value.
Well, a fair number that would represent our loss. You know, I've been there for 56 years myself in our family, and I've had a successful business all these years and a great clientele and all of that. So suddenly one day... I'm not there anymore. That represents quite a loss to me.
Yeah, tell us about a little bit more about your shop. Where does it fit into the area that it's in now? Is there a neighborhood now around that area, or have most other businesses moved out? Or
no, this is prime downtown Oakland property. There's two blocks here that are involved in this Uptown project, and the city incrementally has bought up everything on our block except myself and my next-door neighbor, Tony Fung, at the Auto House. And so we are just trying to be properly compensated here.
Yeah, what about other businesses that decided to move and accept the city's offer? Have you talked
about... on our block, we are the only ongoing businesses. The other properties that the city has bought have either been vacant buildings or situations where there's absentee owners and they wanted to get out. And they actually, some of them went to the city and made a deal, and that was it. But Tony Fung and myself are the only two situations where we own the property, we own the business, and we run the business. That's
now, did
very
the city,
different from the rest of them that were on the block.
Did the city have your businesses declared a blight? And if so, how did they go about doing that?
Yes, they did. California redevelopment laws are very powerful, and they can come in with that blight tag on there. And blight doesn't necessarily have to be visible. It can be economic. So if they feel that they are not producing the highest tax revenue, then they can label your property blighted.
How much public support have you gotten in this fight?
Well, all of our customers are in shock when they find out what's happened here. And the newspapers have picked up on this, and we've gotten some exposure here. And when people find out what's happened, oh my gosh, it's the backlash that is brewing here is a groundswell.
What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm joining the ranks of the unemployed right now after being in business for 56 years. Relocation is not possible for me. I am a one-man operation. I have no employees. And I have that by choice because I can control the quality of the work that leaves my shop. That's very important to me. And all of my customers will attest to the fact on how well they were treated. I made tire and brake and front-end work a very comfortable transaction.
Mm-hmm.
So now that they have to go and find somebody else, they're kind of lost.
Are you of retirement age, Mr. Ravelli? Or?
I am 65.
But you didn't want to retire.
I didn't want to retire. I'm very happy doing what I did. And I look forward to going to work every day. And I'm still in very good physical shape. And I just felt that this was my calling, and this is what I like to do.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Mr. Ravelli.
Thank you.
John Ravelli was the owner of Ravelli Tire, claimed by the city of Oakland earlier this month under eminent domain. He joined us from his home in Oakland, California. We turn now to Doug Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University and author of Zoning and Planning Law. He joins us from his office in Malibu, California. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Let's first go over how the Supreme Court ruling changed laws regarding eminent domain. Let's just review what the Supreme Court said.
Sure. The Supreme Court had before it a program for economic development in New London, Connecticut. And the issue was whether or not the words in the Constitution, which provide that private property shall not be taken for public use without the payment of just compensation, included not just actual public use in the sense of a post office or a fort or a road, or even the right of the general public to use something as in a railway or a utility, but included the desire on the part of a community for economic enhancement of the type of urban renewal or redevelopment projects that one has seen in many urban areas. This one was going to clear a number of homes, about 15 homes, and displace people in order to construct a park and several upscale neighborhoods, as well as a commercial office building. The Supreme Court of the United States, by a 5-4 vote, said that they would defer to the judgment of the local legislature in deciding that public use could mean a public purpose. There was a very strong dissent written by Justice O'Connor that said that that was effectively writing the words public use out of the Constitution and subjecting everyone's individual home and business to the prospect of being taken.
Well, are we already beginning to see the effects of this decision? Are we already beginning to see cases popping up that couldn't have otherwise?
Well, I think there has been a a certain public acknowledgement of these cases that didn't exist. Whether the actual number of cases has increased, it's harder to say. But for the most part, in the past, these cases were below the radar. They affected, like the shop owner you had on a moment ago, an individual person or a small set of individuals. These people did their best to defend themselves against the eminent domain actions, but it's very costly from the standpoint of legal representation, and other people just wouldn't become interested because it wasn't their immediate fate. One of the things that the Supreme Court decision has done is focused on this, allowed the public to focus on this practice, and people who catalog these things say that there are some 10,000 or so instances of threatened or actual condemnations for economic development that can be documented between 1998 and now, and that, in fact, there are a number of cases that have emerged since the Supreme Court opinion that are as troubling as the Supreme Court facts itself.
Are states, what are state legislatures doing about this ruling?
Well, they have become very active. A large number of states have sought to amend their state constitutions or to enact limitations in their codes. Of course, none have been enacted thus far, but they come in a variety of forms. As you might guess, there's an effort to return the definition of public use to a more actual or tangible public use, or one that is directed at preventing a harm, and one sees that as a archetype of reform. But there are others as well. There are some that...
Hold that thought for when we return from a very short break. Doug Kamek is professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University. We're talking about eminent domain. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is out today. In the new order of eminent domain, rundown businesses can become luxury condos. A go-kart track can disappear beneath a shopping mall. And underdog liberals can join forces with property advocate conservatives to fight a Supreme Court ruling both sides feel is unjust. We're talking about the new battles over eminent domain a month after the Supreme Court ruled that in some situations, communities can take private property for commercial developments. We want to hear from you. If you've been involved on either side of an eminent domain case, what do you think of the policy? If you're in a community that's trying to change the rules, tell us about that. Our number is 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Doug Kamek. He's the author of Zoning and Planning Law, and he's a professor at Pepperdine University in California. Professor Kamek, before we went on the break, you were outlining some of the moves that state legislatures are making in response to the Supreme Court decision. Maybe you can just continue with that.
Yeah, Lynn, let me just mention a few other forms in which that state legislation comes. I mentioned that many of the states have tried to narrow the definition of public use so that it's closer to the actual words used in the Constitution. But some have been more specific than that. Connecticut, for example, from where this Kelo case, the Supreme Court case, emerged, has legislation pending that would prohibit the acquisition of owner-occupied residential homes when the purpose of the eminent domain is economic development. Other states would seek to limit the use of economic development where the only motivation for eminent domain was for higher tax bases and tax revenue, and still others have tried to create an ingenious system where even if they can't stop the eminent domain in advance, that a private owner would have the ability to repurchase their property for fair market value after a public use ceased. So you see a good deal, as you would expect, among the states of experimentation of how to address this topic. And the Congress of the United States itself has gotten into the act, and there is pending legislation in both the Senate and the House that would limit eminent domain for purposes of economic development when it is supported by federal money.
If you'd like to join our discussion on eminent domain, the number is 1-800-989-8255. We're discussing that issue and the Supreme Court ruling's effect on eminent domain cases around the country. Let's go to Mark in New London, Connecticut, the epicenter of this debate. Mark, hi. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I just want to say that although I was in favor of the initial decision by the City Council to, you know, take and use eminent domain for the economic purpose, I think in the broader context, it is appropriate for the city governments to have that ability. I think it was proper, regardless of my opinion, to give that right to the City Council. We went through a very lengthy process over which time, if the people of New London or any other jurisdiction for that matter did not agree with what the City Council was doing, they had the opportunity to vote them out and put people in office to stop the process. But I think the process is most efficient at the city level without the Supreme Court telling us what we can and cannot do with our own land.
Okay, thanks for your call, Mark.
Thank you.
Professor Kamek?
I think Mark's point is interesting because one of the things that the majority of the Supreme Court, Justice Stevens, said that he was most impressed by was the thoroughness of the planning that New London did for this proposal. But here's the rub. No matter how thorough the planning, no matter how much support a majority gives to even a particularly good economic plan, if it displaces you from the only home you've known for your entire life or a small business that is the essence of your livelihood and your personality, the Constitution of the United States says it is not the power of the majority to displace you from your home or to displace you from your business. And so, as a policy matter, it may well be that economic development is a good, but the Constitution has suggested that property is of such importance to individual liberty that sometimes the majority has to yield to even one person.
And how does a city determine that an area is blighted? Is there a specific definition for that, or can it be very subjective?
It depends on the state.
And can that be manipulated if it's subjective?
There are many people in practice who will tell you that the numbers can be cooked. And it is demonstrated both in terms of findings of a nuisance, in terms of harmful uses of property, which would probably be the most acceptable definition of blight. Obviously, no one should have a justification for the maintenance of property that threatens the health and safety of the general public. That wasn't the case, by the way, in New London, Connecticut. But the definition of blight starts to get more liquid and manipulable when you start talking about decline in tax ratables, when you start talking about the absence of economic activity generated at the retail level. It may well be that the small mom-and-pop store doesn't produce a great deal of tax revenue or less than the Ritz Hotel would, but nevertheless, it is producing a positive sum for the people who have invested their life in it. But blight does have that capacity to look at absolute numbers without looking at the subjective values or things involved.
Let's take a call from David in Salt Lake City. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I own a small business here in Salt Lake City, and it's in an area that is scheduled to become one of these areas which is redeveloped for commercial purposes. My particular situation is such that the replacement value on my property is about twice what the actual market value would be. And so even if I am bought out of my property by the local government, I'm going to be in a really difficult financial situation because of the way I use my property. It's going to cost me twice as much to replace it.
Now that's a story that I guess we're hearing a lot of these days, Professor Kamek.
Well, here's there are two provisions in the Constitution. One is the provision that we've been talking about, a requirement for public use, which was greatly weakened by the Supreme Court's opinion. And then there's the requirement of just compensation. And as your caller mentions, just compensation is interpreted as fair market value. But oftentimes, fair market value simply doesn't capture the true value of the property for a number of very logical reasons. In the case of the caller, it's perhaps investment in unique improvements that are of great value to his business but would not be of general value to the market. And compensation law has, for the most part, not allowed those extra values to be recaptured. In the context of single-family homes, the value is often things that don't translate into dollars. This is the place where your son or daughter took their first steps. This is the place where a wedding was conducted in the backyard. This is the place where there's all sorts of memories about one family member or another. And our personalities, as Oliver Wendell Holmes mentioned generations ago, just simply become so entwined with this physical property that any taking of it is a taking of an aspect of our person.
Thanks for your call, David. For every sad story of a family losing its home, there is an urban planner searching for strategies to improve an entire community. Joining us now to talk about the different components of urban planning is Ken Reardon, chairperson of the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and he joins us by phone from his school, from his office at the school. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Let's talk about redevelopment. That's a term that we're hearing a lot of in relation to the Supreme Court case. Let's define it. What do we mean by redevelopment?
Redevelopment is an approach to comprehensive revitalization of an area that's suffered from long-term economic losses, usually due to disinvestment by businesses and eventually property owners and occasionally homeowners.
Yeah. And who's involved? I mean, let's talk about the players and the roles they take on in this process.
You know, it might be different in every community. Ideally, a city that hopes to facilitate a revitalization or redevelopment of an area wants to involve all of the important stakeholders, longtime homeowners, renters, institutional leaders from churches, mosques, synagogues, shuls, fraternal organization, local business owners, lenders in the area, and other public and quasi-public agencies to develop a comprehensive strategy for addressing concrete economic and community problems.
Yeah. So how does this then affect urban planning, the Supreme Court decision? How is it going to affect your job?
Well, eminent domain in the post-World War II period has been a critical tool for revitalization. Whenever there is a hint within urban real estate markets that an area might be a target of new public or private investment, there is a very quick movement in the market to for speculators to move in and take advantage of what they expect to be quick earnings and quick benefits. That can often, that the purchase by folks who have no long-term interest in the area but are just speculating in the market, they could be there or Atlantic City or Las Vegas, can often make the economics of any revitalization process just break down and make it impossible for that needed development to occur. In those circumstances, the city really needs this tool, and the question is it applied in a fair and even manner? Are the benefits that are generated for the community greater than the cost to those who are going to be negatively affected? And our previous caller talked about not only the economic costs, which are considered within fair market value, but also the social, psychological, spiritual, and communal losses, because we all know that whether you're a longtime business owner who's operated out of a corner for 50 years or a longtime renter or homeowner, your space is more than just the four walls and a roof.
But how much do urban planners and city governments, how much do they really take those emotional factors into account when they're weighing everything?
Increasingly, towns and cities and small communities are being forced to do it because people's confidence in publicly led development is sort of at an all-time low. People are concerned about the fairness within the system and the degree to which they have been given a fair voice in the process. So community groups are highly organized today, and they demand participation from Jump Street in collecting of the data, its analysis, and the laying out of the overall framework. And, you know, there are 3,000 or more today community-based development organizations, CDCs, which represent, along with community organizations, a strong countervoice to centralized planning agencies and private developers. So it's a much more negotiated process than it might have been in the 40s and 50s when urban renewal was at its height.
Ken Reardon is the chairman of the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're going to take a call from Kenya in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Kenya.
Hi. Hi, yes, I'm an eminent domain attorney here in Charlotte, and, you know, though I stand to benefit from the Supreme Court decision because I represent property owners whose, you know, property has been taken, I strongly disagree with their decision, and I think that the professor in Malibu has a good point. He mentioned nuisance law, which I think people have not really been talking about. In terms of blighted areas, I think nuisance law was really designed to deal with that. And, you know, it's just eminent domain was used because it's more expedient. But I think, you know, the government already has a tool in its arsenal to be able to acquire.
Just remind us of how the nuisance law would be used as opposed to eminent domain.
Well, at least here in my area, if you've got a property that has been, it's decreased in value, I think the amount is 60% of its value has basically been eroded because the property has not been kept up to par. It's got various code violations and things like that. There are notices that go out from the state that warn the property owner about the violations, and if they're not taken care of in a timely manner, then the state has the right to go in and at least demolish the offending property. And that does happen, and they send the bill to the property owner, and the property owner still owns the land, but at least the nuisance-causing structure is no longer there. And, you know, you could say that a property owner that would allow their property to deteriorate to such a degree, you know, might be a willing seller. Now, granted, that type of process would be, you know, it would take much longer, but it's a tool that we have that I think is less offensive than using eminent domain.
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
And just one last question for you, Professor Kamek, and that is, let's just talk a little bit about the politics of opposition here. There are some very strange bedfellows forming against the Supreme Court decision.
Well, it is, as you mentioned, one that brings conservative and liberals together because from the liberal side, it is obviously a threat to individual rights and individual freedom. From the conservative side, it's a threat to property and economic liberty, and as a result, it forges that alliance. That's perhaps not that surprising, Lynn. I mean, it was James Madison who told us that the very purpose of our government is the preservation of property and to preserve it impartially. I think one of the salutary things here is that the discussion is happening, number one, and number two, that people do realize that there are goods on both sides, as Dr. Reardon outlined. The people who are doing urban planning are not doing it from a malevolent point of view, seeking to destroy houses. On the other hand, there is a need to respect the text of the Constitution and the individual rights that are embodied in property rights. And if one is to be asked to do the extraordinary thing for the good of the public, that there be some genuine concern that those people are not asked to do that as a matter of complacency with a great deal of deference, but are only doing it as a matter of last resort when the project couldn't otherwise be developed or when there is some serious health and safety threat.
All right. Thanks for joining us today, Professor Kamek.
Lynn, good to be with you.
Doug Kamek is professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California, and the author of Zoning and Planning Law. When we return from our break, we'll continue our discussion about eminent domain with Ken Reardon, the chair of the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University. And we are going to discuss redevelopment in Baltimore. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Today, we're talking about how local communities are implementing or fighting the Supreme Court's ruling to expand the power of eminent domain. With us is Ken Reardon, chairman of the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University. And we turn now to Baltimore, Maryland, a city that has seen dramatic redevelopment over the past decade. Ralph Tyler is the city's solicitor, and he joins us now from his office in Baltimore to talk about redevelopment and eminent domain from the city government's perspective. Thanks very much for joining us, Mr. Tyler.
Thank you.
Tell us, how does the city of Baltimore acquire land for redevelopment purposes?
Well, in a number of ways, just as in the New London case, typically and most commonly through willing sellers, but when we're unable to negotiate agreements with people to acquire tracts of land when there's a need to do so for urban development, the city does have the authority, confirmed by the Supreme Court, to take the property and to pay the landowner just and fair compensation.
Let's talk about that, because that's the issue we've been hearing a lot about here. A couple of issues coming up with people who are on the other side of this issue. One is that they feel that, you know, property values are rising very quickly in many cities, your own included, that they're not getting fair compensation. And then there are the more intangible things. Someone we spoke with earlier had been in business for 56 years. He was losing his business. People losing family homes. How do you weigh all those things so that you really are giving fair compensation to those landowners?
Well, the answer is that we've had a system in this country for over 200 years. It's a right to a jury trial to determine property values. The property owner has a right to put on evidence, to call appraisers as witnesses, as does the government, and the fair value is determined. I think that the real point that one has to keep in mind is that if one were to suggest that government didn't have the authority to, under certain circumstances, to take property and, again, pay just compensation, you wouldn't be able to build highways in this country. You wouldn't be able to build military bases. You wouldn't be able to establish parks. You wouldn't be able to build dams. All kinds of things that are well-recognized public purposes. And what the Supreme Court said, consistent with what it said previously, is that economic development is, when it's so recognized by the legislative body, a legitimate public use.
I want to see if we can get one more call before we draw a close to this discussion. Ed in Tempe, Arizona. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question was this. Can the economic development priorities now be defined in a way that would allow for community to use eminent domain to promote local downtown merchants, for example, by getting rid of big box stores like Walmart that are sucking the local economy dry?
Ralph Tyler?
Well, I think the answer is what the Supreme Court has said, is if you have an urban renewal plan that identifies a public purpose, if you could show, for example, to the satisfaction of the local government, that you would generate more jobs, that you would generate more tax revenue, that you would generate more economic development through a new approach versus an existing approach, there's no reason to believe that would not be a public use.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Tyler.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ralph Tyler is the city solicitor of Baltimore. He joined us by phone from his office in Baltimore. And Ken Reardon, just one last question. As you mentioned earlier, a lot of state legislatures are now trying to act to perhaps limit the new powers granted by the Supreme Court. Is there any concern out there that that may make it ultimately more difficult for cities?
I think absolutely, and I think you have to look at the specific legislation that's being proposed and what are the factors on which they're suggesting, you know, a public purpose can be established and under what conditions and how fair market value is going to be determined. I mean, those are the two sort of key concerns. And, you know, the terrible tragedy in these cases where there's a very tight market for housing, the folks who are often the victims or being displaced by eminent domain are longtime residents and merchants who've stuck with a neighborhood despite all of its economic difficulties. And their, you know, vigilance and staying there and their advocacy of the neighborhood has often been the factor that's triggered the attention of public and private agencies. And then they find themselves at the risk of perhaps being displaced because of the application of eminent domain, which is almost always a last resort strategy on the part of the public sector.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Lynn.
Ken Reardon chairs the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. He joined us from his office there.